This is Abundance. I'm your host, Dane Allred. Every week, I discuss one of the 1,001 things I'm thankful for here on Abundance. My list of 1,001 thanks includes things like aspirations, attention, just to mention two topics found under A in my list of 1,001 thanks. Today, we'll examine questions. It's number 743. Listing the things I'm thankful for helps me remember I live in a provident, satisfying, wonderful world, and you are one of the best things about it. Welcome to Abundance. Funny thing happened on the way to Dane Allred. Craft Services. I've acted in over 30 commercials and about 20 films. Most of the parts aren't huge, so I get to spend a lot of time at Craft Services. If you watch, you'll see Craft Services listed as the credits roll in most movies. And I want to tell you how important a part they play. It has to do with the long hours of shooting commercials or movies and the tendency of actors to wander. Let's talk about the hours. A regular contract day for film or commercial is 12 hours. This means you work about 5 or 6 hours before eating lunch, and dinner is usually about 4 hours later. If you end up working longer than 12 hours, then everyone starts getting overtime pay, which is time and a half. The longest shooting day I've ever done was 18 hours. We showed up for a combined episode of Touched by an Angel and Promised Land. And this means that all of the stars have to be filmed and released earliest, since they get 12 hours before they can be called to the set again the next day. So after I showed up and I got my cop costume and my fake ID badge and had my face powdered and my hair approved, I sat with the other extras for 12 hours. Oh, that's right. We were ready, but they weren't ready for us. And since we're the least well-paid actors on the set, I had lunch and dinner before even shooting one scene. Since I'd shown up at 8 o'clock in the morning, I started getting overtime at 8 p.m. I finally finished my last scene at 2 in the morning, and the worst news of all is I don't think any of the scenes I was in were used. It doesn't matter. I still got paid. But more important, I got to spend most of the day at the Craft Services table. Now, as actors, we're not the sharpest knives in the drawer, and every actor tends to think of themselves as the most important person on the set, so when we get hungry or thirsty, we start to wander, looking for something to eat or drink, and we may even wander off just because we're bored. Enter Craft Services. Think of all the different foods you may want to snack on. Add a variety of delicious drinks. Put them on a table, and that is Craft Services. The best part? Everything on the Craft Service table is free. That is correct. Lunch and dinner are free too, but here at Craft Services is a collection of incredibly delicious snacks, and you can have as much as you want of anything. Don't tell the directors and the casting agents, but I would act in some parts just for Craft Services. Sometimes the people who are providing the Craft Services get a little creative. They try to serve healthy foods. I don't like that as well. When a free chocolate donut is staring me in the face, who wants some hummus? But don't get me wrong. I haven't preserved my girlish figure by passing up free food. If all there is available is hummus, I'll be eating all the free hummus I can get. Now, let me tell you about the best food I've ever had on a movie set. Henry Winkler and Ricky Schroeder were starring in a movie being shot at the old Jordan High School. I was playing the vice principal, and again, I don't think any of my scene got used. It's okay. I still got paid. The best news is we were in the final days of shooting, and when a film is done, it's called a wrap, and the food on that day, on the day a film is wrapped, is amazing. Think about it. Here are actors who've been working together on films for a week, and as it ends, a real celebration is necessary. The bad news is extras eat last. Now the crew, sound and film, lights, grips, eat first, so they can be back at the camera first. The stars eat next, so they can be ready for their close-ups. extras are last, but on this very important wrap day, I had heard a rumor about what was being served. Again, this is free food because no one wants actors wandering off to Wendy's. Now, when lunch was called, I made sure I was at the front of the line. That is, I was the first extra in line. We were being served the largest lobster tails I have ever seen. I can still taste how delicious it was. And it may surprise you to hear that the caterers at these events are very, very good. I always look for food at lunch, and if we're lucky, at dinner. Surprisingly, after getting used to the free food available at craft services and from the caterers, I have started to cut back. After all, there are fewer parts available for hefty actors. Dane Allred's World of Hurt, Bicycle Crashes. As a kid, I was always crashing my bike into cars. I know that I crashed my bike at least 5 times into just as many cars, which were usually just innocently parked on the street. The sad part of the story is that most of these crashes probably could have been prevented if I had only lost my fascination with my back wheel. I loved to watch it turn. As an adult, I'm still too preoccupied with traffic behind me, and the only correction I remember receiving about driving from my dad was, "Stop looking in the rearview mirror." For some odd reason, I remember being fascinated with the wheel under and behind me. Maybe I was worried it wasn't working right, or I was looking for the source of a strange noise, but I really think it was just my excitement about the mechanical marvel that is a bicycle. The saddest part of the story is that I actually looked back at the wheel when I was close to a car, and then suddenly I was on the ground and wondering what had happened. I don't think I ever stopped to think about the car owners, to tell them about what I had done to their car. I'm sure I slashed tires and dented fenders, but usually I was limping home instead of wondering whose car was the latest victim. The worst case ever was when I went over the handlebars onto the street. The only bad thing about being male is the dangling dangers which can suddenly meet up with sharp handlebar bolts. I won't bother to explain if you don't already get it, but suffice it to say that I didn't report this accident to my mother. I was too embarrassed, being only 8 years old. The only other serious injury from bicycling came from making the mistake of riding barefooted. You really don't think about how hard the asphalt is until you drag your big toe across a strip of it. I must have dragged my toe for a foot or more, and it was excruciating. It swelled up and turned blue. I had a ridiculously painful throbbing later, and the toenail had to be pierced with another hot needle to release the blood behind it. The toenail eventually fell off, and a replacement grew back. It was quite attractive, if I do say so myself. I wish I could say that my bicycle incidents stopped when I graduated to the hottest thing of his day, the 10-speed bicycle. Back then, they were incredibly heavy and unstable compared with today's bikes. I even got to repaint my bike after it had been in enough crashes. It was a candy apple red with sparkles in it that started to peel off almost as soon as it was painted. But that bike saw me through thick and thin. One way to certainly injure myself was learning to drive this newly acquired machine with no hands. The older guys did it, and based on my accidents when I was younger, I tried to make sure I was always far away from cars when I practiced this precision-balanced insanity. I learned to be able to ride with my arms folded across my chest as I traveled down Redwood Road, one of the highest traffic roads in my area. Going fast always helped, but when you crashed, it hurt more. We lived on a pretty steep hill in Benyon, which was great when you were going downhill and not so great going uphill. The first time I went too fast down the hill, I also tried to turn on the canal road. The good news was that I was already past the canal as I realized I was going too fast. the gravel on the other side of the road slipped my wheels out from under me as soon as I made the mistake of putting on the brakes. The bike went sideways right into the large ditch. I slid for a while on the road before also being unceremoniously dumped into the ditch, having the unique experience of dragging my palms across 2 or 3 feet of gravel before my ignominious landing. I sat at the bottom of a deep ditch with bleeding palms filled with gravel, wondering how long it would take me to limp back up the hill and get bandaged. Or I could just tough it out, wipe the blood on my pants, and get on my way to whatever it was I was hurrying to so fast. I think I must have been going to baseball practice, so I took it like a man. I gingerly rubbed my scraped up hands on my pants until most of the gravel was gone, and then went to practice. Where else can you hear someone else in pain instead of yourself? If nothing else, maybe you're able to shake your head and wonder why I'm still alive. Sometimes I wonder myself. Today on Abundance, we're examining questions. It's number 743 on my list of 1,001 thanks. I see an abundance of hope in this world because whenever people decide they want a certain kind of world, we find a way to create it. I also look forward to the day when all people of the earth can live together in harmony, even with differing opinions, goals, and desires. When we respect the others we find living this life with us, we begin to realize we're all in this together, and we must find a way to coexist. I know we can find a path for everyone to thrive. You're listening to Abundance. When I think of the abundance of this world, I think of great literature. I feature it here on the program, and then after some editing, I put those pieces on the web, available as a podcast you can listen to anytime, anywhere, always available at danealred.com. First, some shorter pieces from William Shakespeare, and in a moment, some more longer short stories. Thank you. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 16 by William Shakespeare. But wherefore do not you a mightier way make war upon this bloody tyrant, time, and fortify yourself in your decay with means more blessed than my barren rhyme? Now stand you on the top of happy hours, and many maiden gardens yet unset with virtuous wish would bear your living flowers. Much liker than your painted counterfeit, so should the lines of life that life repair, which this time's pencil or my pupil pen, neither in inward worth nor outward fair, can make you live yourself in eyes of men. To give away yourself keeps yourself still, and you must live, drawn by your own sweet skill. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 17 by William Shakespeare. Who will believe my verse in time to come, if it were filled with your most high deserts? Though yet heaven knows, it is but as a tomb which hides your life and shows not half your parts. If I could write the beauty of your eyes, and in fresh numbers number all your graces, the age would come to say, this poet lies. Such heavenly touches ne'er touched earthly faces. So should my papers, yellowed with their age, be scorned like old men of less truth than tongue, and your true rights be termed a poet's rage, and stretched meter of an antique song. But were some child of yours alive that time, you should live twice, in it and in my rhyme. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 18 by William Shakespeare. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? Thou art more lovely and more temperate. Rough winds do shake the darling buds of May, and summer's lease hath all too short a date. Sometime too hot the eye of heaven shines, and oft is his gold complexion dimmed, and every fair from fair sometime declines, by chance or nature's changing course untrimmed. But thy eternal summer shall not fade, nor lose possession of that fair thou owest. Nor shall death brag thou wanderest in his shade, when in
eternal lines, to time thou growest, so long as men can breathe or eyes can see, so long lives this, and this gives life to thee. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 19 by William Shakespeare. Devouring time, blunt thou the lion's paws, and make the earth devour her own sweet brood. Pluck the keen teeth from the fierce tiger's jaws, and burn the long-lived phoenix in her blood. Make glad and sorry seasons as thou fleets, and do whate'er thou wilt, swift-footed time, to the wide world and all her fading sweets. But I forbid thee one most heinous crime. Oh, carve not with thy hours my love's fair brow, nor draw no lines there with thine antique pen. Him in thy course untainted do allow for beauty's pattern to succeeding men. Yet do thy worst, old time, despite thy wrong, my love shall in my verse ever live young. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 20 by William Shakespeare. A woman's face with nature's own hand painted hast thou, the master mistress of my passion. A woman's gentle heart, but not acquainted with shifting change, as is false women's fashion. An eye more bright than theirs, less false enrolling, gilding the object whereupon it gazeth. A man in hue, all hues in his controlling. Much steals men's eyes and women's souls amazeth. And for a woman wert thou first created, till nature, as she wrought thee, fell a-doting, and by addition me of thee defeated, by adding one thing to my purpose nothing. But since she pricked thee out for women's pleasure, mine be thy love, and thy love's use their treasure. Thank you. you like those selections, go to Literature Out Loud. It's available anywhere on the internet. 100 poems and short stories are available for anyone to read and listen to at their leisure. You can find them at danallred.com or the Mirror site, 1001thanks.com. These podcasts and poems and short stories are being used all over the world with 11,000 visitors to the website. This is a great world. We live in times only dreamed of by people of the past. Right now I'm speaking to all the world, and you can listen live on the internet or at your convenience by podcast. Another selection from Literature Out Loud will start right now. One of my favorite stories by Saki H.H. Monroe. Dusk by Saki H.H. Monroe. Norman Gortsby sat on a bench in the park with his back to a strip of bush-planted sward fenced by the park railings and the row fronting him across the wide stretch of a carriage drive. Hyde Park Corner, with its rattle and hoot of traffic, lay immediately to his right. It was some 30 minutes past six on an early March evening, and dusk had fallen heavily over the scene, dusk mitigated by some faint moonlight and many street lamps. There was a wide emptiness over road and sidewalk, and yet there were many unconsidered figures moving silently through the half-light or dotted unobtrusively on a bench and chair, scarcely to be distinguished by the gloom in which they sat. The scene pleased Gortsby and harmonized with his present mood. Dusk, to his mind, was the hour of the defeated. Men and women who had fought and lost, who hid their fallen fortunes and dead hopes as far as possible from the scrutiny of the curious, came forth in this hour of gloaming, when their shabby clothes and bowed shoulders and unhappy eyes might pass unnoticed, or at any rate, unrecognized. A king that is conquered must see strange looks. So bitter a thing is the heart of man. The wanderers in the dusk did not choose to have strange looks fastened on them. Therefore they came out in this bat fashion, taking their pleasure sadly in a pleasure ground that had emptied of its rightful occupants. Beyond the sheltering screen of bushes and palings came a realm of brilliant lights and noisy rushing traffic. A blazing, many-tiered stretch of windows shone through the dusk and almost dispersed it, marking the haunts of those other people who held their own life's struggle or at any rate had not had to admit failure. So Gortsby's imagination pictured things as he sat on his bench in the almost deserted walk. He was in the mood to count himself among the defeated. Money troubles did not press on him. Had he so wished, he could have strolled into the thoroughfares of light and noise and taken his place among the jostling ranks of those who enjoyed prosperity or struggled for it. He had failed in a more subtle ambition, and for the moment was heartsore and disillusionized, and not disinclined to take a certain cynical pleasure in observing and labeling his fellow wanderers as they went their ways in the dark stretches between the lamplights. On the bench by his side sat an elderly gentleman with a drooping air of defiance that was probably the remaining vestige of self-respect in an individual who had ceased to defy successfully anybody or anything.
His clothes could scarcely be called shabby. At least they passed muster in the half-light. But one's imagination could not have pictured the wearer embarking on the purchase of a half-crown box of chocolates or laying out ninepence on a carnation buttonhole. He belonged unmistakably to that forlorn orchestra to whose piping no one dances. He was one of the world's lamenters who induce no responsive weeping. As he rose to go, Gortsby imagined him returning to a home circle where he was snubbed and of no account, or to some bleak lodging where his ability to pay a weekly bill was the beginning and end of the interest he inspired. His retreating figure vanished slowly into the shadows, and his place on the park bench was taken almost immediately by a young man, fairly well-dressed but scarcely more cheerful of mien than his predecessor. As if to emphasize the fact that the world went badly with him, the newcomer unburdened himself of an angry and very audible explicative as he flung himself into the seat. "You don't seem to be in a very good temper," said Gortsby, judging that he was expected to take due notice of the demonstration. The young man turned to him with a look of disarming frankness which put him instantly on his guard. "You wouldn't be in good temper if you were in the fix I'm in," he said. "I've done the silliest thing I've ever done in my life." "Yes?" said Gortsby dispassionately. "Came up this afternoon, meaning to stay at the Patagonian Hotel in Berkshire Square," continued the young man. "When I got there, I found it had been pulled down some weeks ago and a cinema theater run up on the site. The taxi driver recommended me to another hotel some way off, and I went there. I just sent a letter to my people giving them the address, and then I went out to buy some soap. I'd forgotten to pack any, and I hate using hotel soap. And then I strolled about a bit, had a drink at a bar, and looked at the shops, and when I came to turn my steps back to the hotel, I suddenly realized I didn't remember its name or even what street it was in. There's a nice predicament for a fellow who hasn't any friends or connections in London. Of course, I can wire to my people for the address, but they won't have gotten my letter till tomorrow morning. Meantime, I'm without any money, came out with about a shilling on me, which went in buying the soap and getting the drink, and here I am wandering about with tuppence in my pocket and nowhere to go for the night." There was an eloquent pause after the story had been told. "I suppose you think I've spun you rather an impossible yarn," said the man presently, with a suggestion of resentment in his voice. "Not at all impossible," said Gortsby judiciously. "I remember doing exactly the same thing once in a foreign capital, and on that occasion there were two of us, which made it more remarkable. Luckily, we remembered that our hotel was on a sort of canal, and when we struck the canal, we were able to find our way back to the hotel." The youth brightened at the reminiscence. "In a foreign city, I wouldn't mind so much," he said. "One could go to one's consul and get the requisite help from him. Here in one's own land, one is far more derelict if one gets into a fix. Unless I can find some decent chap to swallow my story and lend me some money, I seem likely to spend the night on the embankment. I'm glad, anyhow, that you don't think the story outrageously improbable." He threw a good deal of warmth into the last remark, as though perhaps to indicate his hope that Gortsby did not fall far short of the requisite decency. "Of course," said Gortsby slowly, "the weak point of your story is that you can't produce the soap." The young man sat forward hurriedly, felt rapidly in the pockets of his overcoat, and then jumped to his feet. "I must have lost it," he muttered angrily. "To lose an hotel and a cake of soap on one afternoon suggests willful carelessness," said Gortsby. But the young man scarcely waited to hear the end of the remark. He flitted away down the path, his head held high with an air of somewhat jaded jauntiness. "It was a pity," mused Gortsby. "The going out to get one's own soap was the one convincing touch in the whole story, and yet it was just that little detail that brought him to grief. If he had had the brilliant forethought to provide himself with a cake of soap, wrapped and sealed with all the solicitude of the chemist's counter, he would have been a genius in his particular line. In his particular line, genius certainly consists of an infinite capacity for taking precautions." With that reflection, Gortsby rose to go, and as he did so, an exclamation of concern escaped him. Lying on the ground by the side of the bench was a small oval packet, wrapped and sealed with the solicitude of a chemist's counter. It could be nothing else but a cake of soap, and it had evidently fallen out of the youth's overcoat pocket when he flung himself down on the seat. In another moment, Gortsby was scudding along the dusk-shrouded path in anxious quest for a youthful figure in a light overcoat. He had nearly given up the search when he caught sight of the object of his pursuit standing irresolutely on the border of the carriage drive, evidently uncertain whether to strike across the park or make for the bustling pavements of Knightsbridge. He turned round sharply with an air of defensive hostility when he found Gortsby hailing him. "The important witness to the genuineness of your story has turned up," said Gortsby, holding out the cake of soap. "It must have slid out of your overcoat pocket when you sat down on the seat. I saw it on the ground after you left. You must excuse my disbelief, but appearances were really rather against you, and now, as I appealed to the testimony of the soap, I think I ought to abide by its verdict. If the loan of a sovereign is any good to you." The young man hastily removed all doubt on the subject by pocketing the coin. "Here is my card with my address," continued Gortsby. "Any day this week will do for returning the money, and here is the soap. Don't lose it again. It's been a good friend to you." "Lucky thing you're finding it," said the youth, and then with a catch in his voice he blurted out a word or two of thanks and fled headlong in the direction of Knightsbridge. "Poor boy. He as nearly as possible broke down," said Gortsby to himself. "I don't wonder either. The relief from his quandary must have been quite acute. It's a lesson to me not to be too clever in judging by circumstances." As Gortsby retraced his steps past the seat where the little drama had taken place, he saw an elderly gentleman poking and peering beneath it and on all sides of it, and recognized his earlier fellow occupant. "Have you lost anything, sir?" he asked.
"Yes, sir. A cake of soap."
Plotter's Mile, Chapter 8. When the news was broadcast later that night, John Graham was sitting in his comfortable living room with Reba, his wife. They were back on level ground again now that the first of the month money fights were over, and watching the local news was their way of winding down the day. John was not prepared for what Paula Rogers would be reporting that night. He had decided not to tell Reba anything about the money until it looked like he'd be able to keep it. Until they would be able to keep it. He was biding his time, but finding the money had added an incredible pressure to his days, as he had to remember not to say anything about the money. Then he had to pretend he didn't know anything about a robbery, and that he hadn't visited with and turned evidence over to the police. Paula Rogers seemed to be trying to change all that. "Look, it's Greg," Reba said, pulling on John's shirt sleeve and turning up the television sound. "It's that nice Paula Rogers girl reporter, too." John had a sudden sinking feeling. Paula Rogers had said $100,000. John could feel the knot growing in his stomach. It felt like an empty pit as he willed the pre-recorded event not to mention his name. Would Greg mention where the evidence had come from? Paula Rogers said, another Paula Rogers exclusive. The lump in his stomach softened a bit. Reba turned to him. "Can you believe that? Right here in our little town, nothing like that ever happens here." She looked at him and waited for a response. "Is that all you have to say?" "Yeah," said Reba. "Your friend is on the television helping with a major investigation, and you say yeah?" Now he was incapable of speech. "What is the matter with you?" Reba inquired, leaning toward the man she'd been married to for a quarter century. She sensed there was more than she was being told. Maybe Greg will be able to keep the money," he probed for her reaction. "Yeah, right," she laughed. "And maybe he'll give some to us." John Graham laughed too, but it didn't really sound sincere. He wondered if Reba noticed.
Schmitty played the flashlight over the murder scene. There was not much blood, but that didn't make Mike Shepard any less dead. From what they could see before the officials arrived, there was trauma to the back of the head, probably from a sharp instrument. "This must be the attendant," Schmitty said to the small crowd of officers gathered around the body. "But what is he doing so far from the booth? Why not just kill him and leave him there? There doesn't seem to be any indication of dragging a body to this location." Three other flashlights played over the ground back toward the station. Zebronski spoke up first. "Maybe the kid decided to take the money back." It was likely what had happened. There was some trauma around the face and hands, like a fight had taken place. But no one's life was worth the couple of thousand that was probably stolen, Schmitty thought to himself. The T-bone was just one of those greasy spoons along the roadway, but since most places like that serve some of the best food around, it was always busy. Paula was glad, since that meant she could work on Greg a bit more seriously than if she had to worry about being overheard. Approaching the booths, which had seats covered with red naugahyde, Greg was ready with his favorite first joke at the restaurant. "Makes you wonder just how many Nagas had to die to make this bench," he said. Paula just smiled. It was Greg's familiar old saw to help him get comfortable, which meant he was comfortable enough to encourage him a bit. She turned away from sitting opposite him in the booth and scooted him over into the corner and sat on the same bench with him. "Will you protect me from the wild Nagas that invade the restaurant to avenge their dead brothers?" She leaned in close and wrapped herself around his closest arm. Greg recognized the approach and slowly disengaged his arm from the entanglement. "You really think I live a life of shoot-em-up adventure, don't you? Or are you just making fun of the sedentary life I lead in a one-cop town?" Paula was not to be put off so easily. "A one-and-a-half-cop town, Officer Jones," she said seductively. "A man with all that power is irresistible." "You're making fun." Greg was still taking it good-naturedly. "We can't all live in the big city with all the big, important news reporters, you know. Some of us have to live out here in Hicksville and protect Ma and Pa Kettle." "Don't start," she said. "I know you love it here and would never move. So don't start humoring me with bad-mouthing the people you adore. And who adore you." She was right, as usual. And this is where the conversations of the past had usually led. She wanted adventure and probably moved from city to city as the affiliates raised her salary and counter-offered each other. He would probably be buried in the cemetery up on the hill after living here his entire life. Greg wanted the conversation to be different tonight, so he decided to take charge of its direction. "I really do want to thank you for the broadcast," he said to her as she stared into his eyes. "I think it will really help to flush out whoever robbed the bank. There's still a short guy out there who will be coming to town to find that money." There was a short guy, just across town, sitting with his mouth open. He, too, had just finished watching Paula Jones reporting on the found money, and even as she was trying her hardest to seduce the local police captain, Ray was making other plans for Greg Jones. So the money was here in town, and the local cops were so kind as to keep it safe until Raymond Johnson decided to pick it up. It was almost too easy. This little hamlet couldn't have more than a few hundred people in it, and that meant the local cop was just a step above the blue light special cop at the local department store. Ray had enjoyed his past encounters with backwater cops. He'd shot a cop or two and could remember the looks on their faces when they realized they were not the fastest draw in the West, that the warm feeling running across their clothes was their own blood. And as they dropped down on their knees, the look of disbelief that crossed their faces just before they died was almost comical. Ray wondered why people, who were pretty easy to kill, actually, were so surprised when they found out they were dead. Maybe someday he would spend time for the murders he'd committed, but he wasn't above a few more murders before the sentence. He also decided that the risk of getting caught doing this murder was very slim. Probably the state cops wouldn't even bother to investigate. What did he have to lose? Beside $100,000. By the time dessert came, Paula had messed up Greg's hair a few times, and by the looks the locals were giving him, they were probably enjoying it more than him. "Paula, Greg, it's all right," she cooed into his ears. "We're both above the age of consent, and this is nothing most of these people haven't seen before." I was going to say, "Let's go somewhere more private." Greg's eyes met hers, and the surprise in her eyes made him laugh out loud. "Sorry, I guess this is kind of sudden." Paula didn't need to be asked twice. She was gathering up her purse as she commented to Officer Jones on his speed. "Yeah, this really is a sudden change of mood after 2 years of me chasing you shamelessly. Now you're sitting there shamelessly and letting me chase you." Greg laughed again. "You're right. You are the world's most patient woman. I'm sorry it's taken 2 years for me to come around." He flipped a 20 on the table and they practically dashed out of the diner. Anyone investigating Officer Greg Jones' house that night would have had an interesting report to file. It would have begun with two people writhing together on the couch. The passion was building, and Paula could feel the objections melting that had stood in her way for 2 years. Greg was also aware of the passion that smoldered beneath him. Paula was doing all she could to go slow because this obviously was not Greg's usual nightcap. He was being careful, far too careful, but being a patient woman, she was able to wait a few moments more. A dark figure passed outside the house and almost tried to twist the front doorknob, but then he heard a moan from within the darkened house and froze in his footsteps, waiting and holding his breath. When he heard some more noise from inside the house, he lightly stepped off the front porch and left quickly, but as quietly as he had approached. Inside the house, Paula Jones had decided to speed things up a bit. She grabbed Greg's broad shoulders and twisted him onto the floor. He was surprised by the sudden movement, but didn't fight and rolled onto the carpet with Paula on top of him. Then she raised up as their hips stayed together. "Not your usual date, I'm guessing by the shocked look on your face," Paula said. "I definitely think I'm in unknown territory here," he confessed. "Thanks again for bringing the show to town," he said, but this time he was not referring to the broadcast. She leaned down slowly and kissed him lightly, then rose back up again, still sitting across his waist. "Glad to oblige," she whispered. "I visited enough these past 2 years. It's about time we got down to business." "Thanks for coming to my town to share," Greg said slowly. He pulled her down toward him. Paula had a strange look on her face and hesitated. Then Paula leaned back slowly and said, "What was that?" I'm just grateful you've been so patient with me," he said, rising up on his elbows. Something was not quite right. Paula stood up, and he was left lying on the floor. "No," she said. "What did you just say about sharing?" Greg stopped and looked up. "All I said was I was grateful." Paula stepped back. "You said you were grateful I was sharing. What did you mean?" "I'm not very good at this, am I?" He apologized. "You must be used to guys who are a little more smooth." Paula was now at least 3 feet away, and Greg was left kneeling in the middle of the room by himself. She straightened her blouse and pulled at her jeans. "What did I say?" Paula turned around and tried to gather her thoughts. This was not turning out how she had hoped, and she was sure this is not what Greg had planned for this evening either. She sat down in a nearby chair. Greg was still unsure what he had done. Now it was his turn to bow his head and wonder how to rescue this night. He could hear her sobbing quietly. He went over and tried to comfort her as best he could, wondering what he could do to make this better. Sitting beside her, he let her have a good cry, during which she turned and sobbed on his chest while he drew her close. "Let's just call it a night. I'll take you back to your motel." Greg could feel her head nod slightly, and he also heard a sigh. It sounded like a sigh of relief. which made him sigh with relief too.